The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Discover a team that's always here to support you at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
And I'm delighted to be joined now by broadcaster Mark Cagney, and he has a story to tell, as you might be aware. Mark, you're very welcome.
Cheers, Brendan. Nice to see you again.
And does being in here conjure up ghosts for you? Is it, have you been back here much?
No, not very much. I came back to do a documentary for the, you know, a little bit of series, but I was just talking, the first time I was in this building, I was in studio, is this six or five?
Yeah, six.
I was filling in for Mike Murphy on Morning Call in 1977. It was my first break on national radio. And then about 2 months later, I was back up and I was filling in for Gay Byrne on the Gay Byrne Hour, which was the big kahuna, I can tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
So
absolutely.
Then, of course, 2FM started then about a year later. So
yeah, we come back to 2FM because I do want to talk to you about that. But in the immediate, and the reason you're agreed to come in today is that you've had a kind of an extraordinary time of it. So it's quite, in a way, like a Johnny Cash song or a country western song. You went out to buy noodles in January and you nearly didn't come back.
Yeah.
You had a stroke in the supermarket.
I did. Oh, well, you know me now, anything for an audience. Friday afternoon, packed. Listen, it's bizarre. Went up to, I live in Sutton Park, which for those of you who know the north side of Dublin is not a million miles away from Sutton Cross, and there's a big supermarket there. It was Fergal Quinn's headquarters for donkey's years, Super Quinn. I know Super Value will hate me for saying that, but anybody who lives in the area always still calls it that. Went up to get a few messages for the dinner on Friday evening, another day in lockdown, one trip out, and Sophie had said to me, there's only a few small bits and pieces. My daughter said, oh, listen, will you get me some of these types of noodles? There's an intersection as you go up towards Sutton, which you take a left, you go down to Baldoyle, Portmarnock, all out that way. And I stopped there, started to feel funny. There was something, a noise started in my head, like a swarm of bees, like tinnitus, actually, in retrospect. Which was, I was like, what the hell's going on? And then I couldn't judge the distance between where I was at the intersection and the car in front of me. In other words, was I okay to go through the junction?
Yeah.
Like, what the hell is going on here? Anyway, kind of abated, moved on, got up to the supermarket, Super Value in Sutton Cross, parked the car, knew straight away, by the way, I'd parked the car, that there was something wrong. What the hell have I done here? I got out of the car, saw it, and it was really odd. I thought, Jesus, people think I'm drunk. You know, this is your first instinct, is what's wrong with you? Anyway, sorted that out, went in, went over to the supermarket, was a queue. And again, you know, with the discs on the ground for social distancing. Mm-hmm. For the first time in all of this, I actually had to look at those to judge, was I too far away or too close to the person in front mm-hmm. of me? And again, the thought was, what's going on here? Went in, took a left, picked up a basket, and then proceeded to knock things off shelves. Well, this is really odd. This okay. is like, what the hell is going on here? Like, again, the thought, people will think you were drunk. Okay, moved on, found the shelf I was looking for the noodles in. They weren't there, and I didn't have my glasses with me. And I thought, God, oh, what a day, you know, you gobbed off. Asked for some help. The girl said, no, actually, they're not there. I'll go and check out the back. 2 minutes later, I came back and she said, no, we don't have them, but we will have them tomorrow. I said, thank you very much. Turned to walk away. Then the room did a 360. Bang, down. And apparently I didn't topple or fall. I went straight down on my knees, just sack of spuds. Bang. Next thing is the fella's leaning over me saying, sir, are you all right? Are you feeling chest pains? Excuse me. I said, no, this is not my chest. I'm telling you, there's something in my head. Not putting two and two together. I had no idea and didn't for quite some time. He said, are you sure? I said, look, I know the heart attack protocols. It's not that. I don't know what the hell it is. Is there somebody we can get for you? Yeah, you can ring my daughter. She'll come and get me. She's only down the road. So Sophie came. She got an awful fright, obviously. She brought me home. I went into my man cave, lay down. And I thought I nodded off again. Next thing, she's leaning over me going, Dad, are you all right? I said, no, I'm fine. I just dozed off. She said, no, you didn't. You went again. And if you'd been standing up, you would have fallen. And I went, oh, right, okay. Then my son came in and he started talking about stroke. At this stage, they're ringing doctors. They're ringing their mother. And Audrey's sister Rita, her future son-in-law, of whom she's very proud, is a registrar in James's. She rang him, Owen, and he said, don't wait for doctors, don't wait for ambulances, get him into Beaumont now, put him in the car and bring him to Beaumont. And then the journey began.
Okay.
No, I haven't taken a breath in about 2 minutes, so you ask a question.
Okay. So how then and when did you find out what had happened?
Initially,
when you heard the word stroke, when your son mentioned stroke.
From my son, yeah. But he was doing looking for the fast things.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there was no sign of any of that.
Okay. So you don't seem like you were unduly worried up to then.
The only thing I was worried about was going to Beaumont.
Yeah.
The last thing I wanted to do was go into hospital because COVID,
yeah.
you know? And no, they were brilliant. It's Friday evening, ED, A&E in Beaumont. You kind of think, I could be there for 2 days before anybody saw me or I got through. And I don't mean that disparagingly, but you know all the horror stories. I was triaged in 3 hours and I was actually in a bed by, I was on a chair in three in a ward and then I was in a bed in 6 hours. A whole load of, they thought it was Meniere's or something, which is a disease I didn't know anything about, but apparently it affects your inner ear balance and causes you to fall over.
Yeah.
Anyway, they did some CT scans and the following morning they said, we found a clot. You've had a pulmonary embolism, which is a clot in your lung. And I went, right, okay. Now, I had had pneumonia a couple of years back. And, you know, I will get one really bad chest infection a year, you know, a real doozy.
Yeah.
And it will knock me out for 3-5 days. So I was obviously shocked, but it didn't surprise me.
Yeah.
But the ED specialist said, however, that doesn't tally with the symptoms that you described to us. So I'm going to order a brain scan, MRI, because there's something going on here that we're not sure of. So they did that. And then they came back and they said, oh, actually, you've had an acute ischemic stroke. You've had a clot in the lower right-hand side at the back of your head. Thankfully, small clot in a big vessel. Here's where I started to get worried. He said, if it was the other way around, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah.
So...
And you're feeling reasonably okay,
I'm
lucid,
feeling like
everything.
I'm a fraud, okay. Brendan. I'm going, what in the name of God am I doing here? And I'm looking around this acute stroke ward at this stage and I'm thinking, these are a range of the scenarios that I associate with stroke. I have,
and I presume, look, like for me, all of us, a stroke for you probably was something that happened to someone else or happened to an old fella or whatever.
Yeah.
So it must be like a big shocker to take in, is it?
It was very, very funny. When we got through the other end of it and they're talking about the recovery process, you know, here's the kinds of things you should be doing in recovery. I looked at the list and I went, I've been doing that for 30 years. I lived like a monk for the last 30 years. Don't drink, don't smoke, eat well, exercise 3 to 4 times a week, hard. You know, it was the discipline that kind of underpinned.
And your blood pressure under control and everything?
Everything. No, I get regular MOTs, no problems. So, like of all of the things that was going to get me or would get me, that was the last thing I would have expected. Yeah. Now, by the way, I my brother had one about two and a half years ago, and I've had a few friends who've been through it.
Yeah.
So it's not that I'm unfamiliar with it. I just didn't think. Do you know, honestly, I always thought, no, I don't want, I'm not even going to say that, right? But I thought maybe it would be something else that would get me. Never that.
Yeah. But come here, you had 2 weeks in a stroke unit then, and I know you're the kind of guy who kind of thinks too much anyway.
Oh.
So, like,
yeah.
I can only imagine where the head was going.
There was there were several very long, dark nights of the soul. Some were related to this time of year, because as you know, with my history, my first wife died there and it was interesting. I was in that ward going, oh, this place is very familiar to me. Ah, sure, they're all the same. It looks like Lego. And I remember the first time I was allowed out of bed and I went out and I looked left and there was a nurse's station. Then I looked right and I saw two red signs, Richmond ICU, and that's where she was. That was 30 years ago this month.
Yeah, and also... Did Anne collapsed also out shopping, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was in Brown Thomas having coffee with her friend Declan Corcoran and she had a brain hemorrhage, a catastrophic one. So there was, I remember looking at that and thinking, oh God. And I went back to bed and that night I was going, this is it. Is this the circle now? Is this, you know, this where it ends? Am I ever getting out of here? Now, look. As you said, think too much and an overactive imagination. So, but like all this mad stuff goes through your head, Brendan, because, I've been incredibly lucky. Look, I've no physical, no loss of power in any of my extremities. no paralysis, no cognitive damage that anybody can... Well, none that wasn't there before.
Yeah,
I know I shouldn't be making jokes about this, but you're from Cork. You get
you're allowed, and you can own your own story.
But you know. So I've been incredibly lucky. I lost my train of thought there now. So what was the question?
Do you know what the question is though? That actually, do you know the way sometimes you see guys who get a turn, and afterwards I sometimes think they have that slight fear in their eyes after it changes them. So you were talking about the dark night of the soul there.
Well, there was the one about my own personal situation, and here I am, and oh dear God, there's a kind of a synchronicity about this that is, you know, way too scary. But in terms of, there was a guy, and I've talked about this already, there was a guy across from me, a lovely guy, young man, three kids, he was in his early 30s, and he'd had a bad one. Now, thankfully, we heard from his wife, actually, my wife heard from his wife on Facebook, that he's in Dunleary and he's doing really, really well. But he, nothing on the right-hand side was working. And I got talking to him, we, you know, talked about football and this and the other. We just were having chats. And but he's from a Gaelic area of the country. So he thinks, breathes, sleeps in Irish first, translates afterwards. It's in his DNA, it's his bones, it's his identity. And he told me that of all of the weird things that the stroke had done to him, taking his Irish, which now, by the way, I believe he's getting back as well. Yeah. But it took his Irish. And it was at that stage I kind of went, hang on a second here. This isn't about, you know, one side of your body not working or whatever. This is about your identity. This can do this. It can go so deeply into your DNA that it can do that to you. And at that stage I began to think, hang on a second. Now, this, you know, I feel grand. I think I'll be fine. Sure, I'll be back in the saddle in 2 or 3 weeks' time or a month or whatever. But this could be... this might not end soon or easily.
Yeah.
So that worried me, that frightened me. And then I began...
And presumably your identity is also fairly wrapped up in being a great talker and able to talk under pressure and, you know, broadcasting and all that. And like you... And broadcasting is a confidence trick, essentially. So you must have been thinking, okay, if I lose that...
Well... I had a great have a great stroke nurse called Sarah Jane Byrne, and she and I didn't hit it off right from the start because she's incredibly optimistic and upbeat, and sometimes I don't do well with that. She was doing her job, and she was brilliant. And we'd have a few tetchy encounters, and I'd be a bit cranky, and I was freaked out. I was going, "Who am I going to be? Who can I be post stroke? Will I ever be me? Will I ever get back to being me? Will people ever think of me like that again? Will anybody ever hire me again? You know, I've had a brain injury. Will people think I'm brain damaged? Am I brain damaged? I don't know. Sure, I'd say I'm fine, but then I would, wouldn't I? Anyway, she around the fourth or fifth visit, she said, "Look, I don't know, I didn't know a lot about you, but I went and did a bit of checking, and it seems to me, from what I know of you now, you're a high functioning individual." And I went, "Well, thank you, nice to say that." She said, "But you, people like you need a purpose, and your purpose is what you do. What you do, it's not what you do, it's what you are.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, you're in trouble. So you need to get back in the saddle as fast as you possibly can, and the sooner you do that, the quicker your recovery will go." And it was the single best piece of clinical stroke medical advice I have got, I personally have got, about how to deal with this. And so I went, right, okay, how do I do this? How do I go about that? How do I get people to give me the chance to show that I can still do what they would expect me to do, be able to do it to the level that they would expect it, be able to do it to the level that I would expect it? So, you know, being here this morning, for example, I'm delighted. I'm always glad to talk to you. You know that, right? But this is... recovery therapy. It's public recovery therapy for me.
Yeah.
Because if I can come in here and I can hold my own with you in this arena, in this environment, it means it's not gone. The mojo is still there, and it's only a matter of just working at it to get it back. And okay, that's my situation, right?
Yeah.
But everybody who has a stroke, pretty much 90% of the people who have them, will go through this, will go through some form of PTSD, anxiety, and really... deep psychological problems and issues about their identity, about who they are, post-stroke, who they can be, what it has robbed them of.
Yeah, and where are you at with all that now?
I don't know. It's a work in progress, Brendan. I'm only starting on it. Each time I do something like this, I go, okay, well, that muscle, that synapse is working. That bit is going.
Yeah.
I can do that. So if I can do that, okay, I'll do the next bit. And eventually, as people... this is risky stuff, Brendan. You get that, right? This is really risky stuff, because if it goes wrong, people go, oh, God, God love them. Oh, yeah. and the phone will never ring again.
Yeah.
But if it works, then great. Like, yeah. On one level, I don't mean this to sound pathetic, right? Yeah. But I'm kind of fighting for my life here. This is what this is about, you know? And like not just me, but everybody else who's gone through this as well.
Yeah, and I think you had a taste of it after you left Ireland AM after 20 years, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Suddenly, like, the phone didn't ring. I mean, well, look, I was going back to radio and making my way back in, and then lockdown. So I'm in the gig economy now. And every musician, actor, anybody in that economy that you know hasn't, like, we haven't worked for a year because there is no work. You can't go anywhere. What do you do?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's. I don't mean this. This isn't. Look, something like this happens to you and you can go on or you can go under. I'm not built to go under. I'm just not doing that.
Yeah.
And if I can do that and say that and say, look, I'm scared. I won't say the word, but you know the word. Yeah. I'm scared less because of what's happened. And I don't know what the future is going to be, but I'm not going without a fight. And if I can do it, you can. Don't give up. Dumb sparrow. While you breathe, you hope.
Yeah. And of course, you are used to the precarious existence of broadcasting.
Yeah, I get
as
all
well.
Of that.
The funny thing is, I was reading there that you grew up in a kind of a different environment as well to a lot of people your age, and that your dad was kind of in the gig economy, wasn't he?
Oh,
you grew
a musician.
Up in that kind of bohemianish.
Well, he did loads of different things, right? He was qualified in electronics. He also went and got his papers as a mechanic and as a welder because he was a kind of a polyglot. He was one of the smartest, brightest people I knew in that sense, and really should have been locked away in a laboratory somewhere or playing music, either which.
Yeah.
He came from a very bohemian existence as well. So it was a very loose house, very free, kind of democratic, a benign, well, no, it was a kind of a, he was a benign despot, but it was democratic in the sense that you were encouraged to think for yourself. You were encouraged to speak for yourself. You were also told to shut up when when it diverged from the party line. It was a very interesting open household. Now, unfortunately, my father and I were very alike. So young stag, old stag, boom, boom, boom.
Yeah, because you left then when you were quite young,
yeah,
didn't you? Tell
16,
us about that.
I was gone before I was 16. I left on Christmas Eve, just after my I was 16 in September. I left on Christmas Eve that year. Maximum effect, of course. Ruined Christmas, being the pup that I was. Make a point, you know?
Yeah.
Grand exit. But it got to the point where it was just, I had left a couple of times before that. It just wasn't working out. He had plans. My life was mapped out. I was going to do the opposite of all the things that he did. I wasn't going to be a musician. I wasn't going to be an actor. I was going to go to college. I was going to get a degree. And then when all that was done, my life was back. I could make my own decisions then. It was all mapped out for me. And I'm going, no, thank you. Not interested. I wanted to be in bands or around them or in music, or I'd know. I'm not academic. I'm not bad with research. I can read and learn, but no, it just wasn't me. I'm not built like that.
Yeah, funny that he wanted you to basically rebel against his way of life by going straight, and you left because of that.
Is that
then.
What parents do?
Yeah. And was there a rift then after that?
Oh, huge
that?
Rift. Yeah, huge rift, and one that was never satisfactorily. As parents, look, my parents were really lovely people, and you ask any of my brothers and sisters, I have four sisters and three brothers, and they will all have great stories and great love and affection for my parents and all the things they did. I was the black sheep. Look, you're the eldest, you're the experiment, and everybody thinks that, you know, parents always get it. Sure, they're learning on the job too. Sometimes it doesn't always go well. There were brilliant grandparents, by the way, and there was a rapprochement later on. There were areas that were, you know, we just didn't go there because it would. I mean, I do remember, this is terrible, and my brothers and sisters will hate this for me. Right? At one stage, after one of the rapprochements, I went away. I lived up at the top of Patrick's Hill, which you know well, right? So we walked up, went in, and I went ahead. Anne was with me at the time. I was married to Anne at the time, and she was struggling with the hill, right? So I actually went into the house about 2-3 minutes ahead of her. She was kind of taking her time. And I went in, and I was in there long enough to have a row with one of my parents. I won't say which one. And to go, right, that's it, bang, and turn on my heel and walk out. And she was literally coming up to the door. And I went, right, we're going. She went, what? It was mad. It was stupid. But it was that stupid. You know what families are like, Brendan.
I mean,
there were brilliant, brilliant people. I was a pup. I was an absolute pup. But I had something in me that, you know, like, I wasn't going under.
Yeah, and you phoned your way. And look, I'll tell you, a lot of the people texting in with great affection are texting in about remembering you at a very formative time in their lives when you were on 2FM. And like, I obviously remember well, you as the, like, the original 2FM DJs. You were like rock stars in Ireland then,
you
weren't
did,
you?
Jerry and I, we were. Yeah. Well, actually, here's the funny thing, right? We were the also-rans. The people who ran daytime 2FM viewed us as being, we were pirates, you know, we were, I don't know what the word, they didn't view us very well, is all I'd say that. And really the attitude to us was, and this, bear in mind, I don't know what RTE is like now, but it was very much a branch of the civil service or public service back then. So 5 o'clock had shut and we were let loose in here. And really the rule was, listen, don't break the furniture, leave the place in some kind of order, right, for the real people the following morning. What happened, of course, was is that we were of and caught the zeitgeist. Ireland was changing culturally and we represented that change. We were there. You know, spies in here. We were the guys who got behind the wire, so to speak. And we
and
were,
you see, kids now won't realize that there was no access to there was no access to music back then the way there is now and everything. So like, you were the guys who gave.
Do you know
it
what
to
we
us?
Found out? And like Dave and I particularly would have been record collectors. Jerry not so much, although he had a decent collection. But we were avid. We were anorak, and we came in here and we discovered that the greatest popular stroke rock music library in the country was in this building. They had everything going back to the very, all of the record companies would send them this stuff, like magical stuff, things that collectors would pay, they'd give you an arm and a leg for, and they were in the library here. There was no outlet for it. But I remember being in here one day, there was a very famous record. It's actually a piece of cack. It's called In a Gadda Da Vida by Iron Butterfly, but it has this mythic status about being one of the great, one of the very first heavy metal records. And I read about this record and, you know, Melody Maker, NME, all that, all the avenues of access to information that we had back then. And even Dave had never heard it. He didn't have a copy of it. And I'm rifling through the library here one day and I come across a pristine copy of In a Gadda Da Vida by Iron Butterfly. And I went, oh my God, into one of the booths, put it on. I went, Jesus, that's shite. Sorry, this is Marion's studio. She'll come back and turn me into it for the result. I'm so sorry.
And then, of course, he went on the road as well.
We did,
And I remember the Beats on the Street and Larks by the Lee and like rock
10,
stars.
12, 15, there were 15,000 people, maybe nearly 20,000 people on the Colcan Cork. I mean, the ones in Stephen's Green were legendary. And we were treated like gods and we thought we were, you know, but... Yeah. Look, we were young and we were having a ball. We were living the dream. We had access to the country's biggest jukebox. We had access to the airwaves and we were representing our people in here playing the kind of music that we loved in the way that we loved for the people out there that we knew loved it as well. As Fanning actually has the best take on it, he said, we got incredibly lucky. We were in the right place at the right time. But I'll add one caveat to that, and we were the right people.
Yeah.
You know, it was, you know, like a really good band, you get, how do you analyze the chemistry? You don't, you just get lucky with it.
Yeah.
And I think everybody got lucky.
And come here, for you yourself, I don't want to talk about anybody else. Did a bit of excess then creep into
of
that?
Course
was there
it
high
did,
living?
Right.
Yeah.
Of course it did. We were young and we were foolish and we were having a great time. And we did what young, foolish people who are having a great time do. We indulged and partook in things that came our way. Do I recommend it? Absolutely not. Do I condone it? Absolutely not. But that's what we did, you know.
Okay. And
each generation
does it. When you say we, you're speaking for yourself
you're a father, right? I'm a father. And each generation has to put its hand in the fire and find out it burns for itself. I stuck my hand in the fire plenty of times. I found out. I grew up. I caught myself on.
Yeah.
And thankfully, I'm able to pass that on to my own kids who haven't repeated any of my mistakes that I know of.
And then I presume then, Your aunt died, so that's 30 years ago. So how old were you at that stage?
I was 34, going on 35.
Yeah, so a young man, your wife dies. I presume you grow up and cop on and all the rest of it very quickly when something like
that
happens.
Well, I've talked to you about this. Like this is grown-up stuff, right? And it devastated me. My kids obviously are the most joyous thing, but the single most defining thing in my life. So there's kind of before that happened and then there was after. It did teach me an awful lot of stuff. It got my priorities right about what's important. Material stuff. And I was doing really, really well at the time. I was working for Dennis O'Brien. I was doing voiceovers. I couldn't fit them in. I had two great jobs, a lot of money, very comfortable. And I was in a hurry to acquire all of that because I had somebody I wanted to do it for, and I wanted to give them a great life. I wanted us to have a great life. And lesson number one, don't ignore the people, not ignore, but don't forget the people that you're doing this for while you're doing it. Because while you're busy doing that, something happens to them, too late. And that stuff that you've accumulated, excuse me, will sit there sneering at you afterwards going, not much use to you now, am I? And it'll matter, you could give all of it and 10 times that amount and you can't get them back. So it's stuff doesn't matter, people matter. So that was lesson number one. You know, and I was a materialistic little at the time. You know, it was the 80s, it was 90s. You know, that was acceptable. The other thing was, for the people that you love and that you care about, make sure that they know it. Now, and to say, of course they do. Just remind them. Just every now and again you go, you do know I love you. You do know I care. You do know that really, that's, you're all that matters. I do this with my kids all the time.
Do you feel you didn't do it enough with that?
No. This is the thing that, the lesson, the great lesson, and the thing that saved me from despair and destruction in the end was that she knew exactly how I felt about her. Exactly. There was nothing unsaid. We'd been to the abyss too many times. So it was always a possibility. She had a very complicated medical history. Nothing was left unsaid. And that was the only thing that saved me, because there was nothing left unsaid. There was no what ifs. She knew exactly how I felt about her. I knew exactly how she felt about me.
Yeah.
Now, I went mad. I went absolutely mad for 6 months. And
mad how?
Mad every way. I went back to some old bad habits. I did everything I possibly could, I suppose. And I kind of tried to check out, but, you know, didn't have the... I want to be very careful here, because this is a very, very touchy subject and very sensitive subject for a lot of people, right? I didn't care. I stopped. I didn't have a reason to get up in the morning. I didn't have a reason to go to work. I didn't have a reason to go on. And I was just going, what's the point? Now, I didn't act on any of it, but I, you know, anyway, whatever. I'm acutely aware that there are people who have been in this situation and didn't end up so well. How close? I don't know. I can't tell you. Right. But I gave up. I gave up because I didn't see any point, and I didn't have anybody to do it for. And I was very angry because I thought of all of the people that this should happen to. No, it shouldn't have happened to her. Yeah, it's very complex. And I'm still, and this is really difficult territory for me, because I've had another life. I have been incredibly blessed. I've had another life afterwards.
Yeah, and Audrey came into your life quite soon after, helped you.
She was one of the saviours, you know. Yeah, she said, you know, to use the old Shawshank thing, you better get busy, better get busy living or get busy dying. You know, you're wandering around with a cut finger and you put a plaster on, you think it's going to be all right. It won't, mate. You need to deal with this.
So yeah, that's interesting what you say, though, that it's difficult territory because you had another life. Is there an element of guilt?
Oh, yeah, of course there is. Of course there is.
Still, yeah.
Should it? Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. And I mean, I lost friends over the second life, because it was like, oh, well, you know, didn't take... Oh, somebody actually said to me, didn't take you long, did it?
Yeah.
How do you deal with that? How do you answer that? Part, I mean, you want to punch them in the face for it, but you kind of go, God, maybe they're right.
Yeah.
But listen, here's the thing, and this is something I learned with the stroke as well. With these huge things, things happen for a reason. Sometimes the reason isn't apparent. But what you do is, excuse me, you look at it. You don't get screwed up and messed up about what you've lost. You be thankful for what you had and for what you've left, what you're left with. So you take the lessons of all of that and then you put them to some use. So, right, that happened. It was awful. It was wonderful. I had 16 great years that a lot of people don't have. Be grateful for that. Yes, it was awful. Yes, I lost it. But she taught me so much, formed me and made me the man I was. And then that man went on to meet somebody else and to have four really, really cool kids. Good kids. Good girl.
Yeah.
That I'm proud of. And I think are proud of their father. So that was the next step. I wish I didn't have to go through the first one. But that's where I am.
Yeah. And you were lucky to get that second chance.
Yeah.
And okay, I don't want to sound kind of twee here or anything. is Anne still there for you all the time, in a sense?
It's funny. I was asked by your researcher about do I pray? I don't pray to a God in the accepted sense. I talk to people who've been in my life, who I know cared for me. She's one. My Aunt Mary, who kind of rescued me from when I was 16. Also my parents still, because, you know, they have to. It's part of the job. Mm-hmm. there's a couple of people that I have that when you're lying in bed at night and you're kind of, you know, terrified and wondering what's next, and you're looking for help. There are people like that. I got a message from one of those the other night, actually. It was a lady who was like my house mother in 98, a woman called Peggy O'Brien, Betty O'Brien. And around the time after Anne died, she would see I was in a bad way, and she'd come in and utter the magical words, "Will I make you a cup of tea, son?" And I'd say, "Yes, please, Peggy." And she'd make the cup of tea, and then she'd come in, and then I'd get the hug with it, and the world seemed a lot better. And I heard from her son, Rocky, the other night, and it was glorious. Because you know, when you're doing these things, sometimes you wonder, should I be doing this? Should I be taking this risk? And I don't know. I'm throwing it out there, and I'm hoping that the universe will catch me. And I was thinking about this, and whether I should actually be doing this, and whether I'm doing more damage or more harm than I'm doing good. And I got that message from Rocky O'Brien, and I went, "That's Peggy. God bless you, woman." Yeah. And I went, because she picked me up and saved me before. And I kind of felt, right. Now, I'm sure there's people at home going, "This is a pile of mumbo jumbo."
I think we all have our own little different ways of seeing the universe and stuff and that. Yeah. And like, so you've thrown yourself into the arms of the universe with this now. I sense you're kind of in a free fall with it at the moment. I'm wondering, like, is the parachute going to open? Are you going to get out? Yeah. What would you like to happen now in an ideal world?
Well, you know, you talked about finishing up with TV3, which, by the way, was grand. I mean, it had come to 20 years doing that, Brendan, and you know this business. That just doesn't happen. It was remarkable. It'll never happen again. And it was right. And probably, you know, if you were managing the career, you probably would have said, you know what, maybe 18 was enough. But it was fine. It was perfect. It was lovely. I got a great send-off. I have no issues about that whatsoever. But during that period, Aidan Cooney is one of my great friends, my best friends, has been for 30-odd years. We used to slag Aidan all the time. We used to say, "You hungry whore, two-job Cooney," because he stayed in radio. I remember one day he said to me, "You only say that to me because you've forgotten how lovely radio is." And I went, "Well, maybe you're right." I get a call from the people in News Talk as soon as I leave, and they say, "Will you come in and do a bit of radio?" And I haven't sat behind a radio microphone in 20 years. So I said, "Well, yeah, okay, grand. I'd love to go in." I'm bricking it. I'm terrified. But first day, get the rust off, grand. Day two, I went, "I'm home." And I rang, in the minute I got out of the studio, I rang Aidan Cooney and said, "You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I'd forgotten." Because I am not a television person. I was never that mad about television as a medium. It was a detour. It was a gig. Yeah. And it lasted for 20 years. When I was 10, 11, 12, 13, going to bed at night, I was dreaming of two things. One, playing for Spurs and scoring a goal in the FA Cup for them in Wembley. And second was being on the radio. That was the job. I had my headset. I used to listen to Radio Luxembourg. My father made me a crystal set when I was about 9 or 10. And until I left home 5, 6 years later, every night, that's what I did. I listened to Bob Stewart and Kit Jensen and Tony Prince and all those people, because we didn't have any other access to music on radio. That's what I dreamed of doing. I never dreamed of being on television. And really, if you think of what I did on TV, I did radio on TV and got away with it. That's what I was doing. So as soon as I walked into that studio and did that again, I went, "This is home. This is actually what I'm meant to do."
Okay.
And that is what I hope I will be allowed to do in the future.
Okay. So there's another chapter here for you. And listen, I'll tell you what, Mark, there's a lot of love out there for you. And a lot of people, as I said, remembering Mark Cagney's Night Train is where I was introduced to so much brilliant music, and quite a few things I heard ended up in my collection. Thanks. And then people saying, Paul in Cork saying, "Great to hear Mark Cagney on the airwaves again. Mark, you should have no worries. You can still easily talk the hind legs off a donkey." So there you go. I think that's a good endorsement. Listen, great to talk to you. Thank you so much for that. And good luck with everything. Mark Cagney, thank you.
Cheers, Brendan.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.